Southern Arizona. We're sitting at one of the coziest houses in the state, admiring the decor that seems to have been acquired and thus so encapsulates several lifetimes of happiness. Somewhere there are three cats lurking, so please excuse any meows or shuffling you may hear during today's episode. Right now it's near sunset, and my guest and I are poised to admire the marbled transition of day to night as we have done since we were children. Today I'm sitting across from a very special guest and one of my oldest friends, Jenny Peterson. Jenny is, of course, a literature enthusiast like all of us. Hello and welcome back to Diddy and Hawthorne in the In-Between. I'm your host, Mackenzie Gentz, and you're listening to my podcast about the relevancy of literature in the 21st century. Now bookmark that book, and let's begin. Welcome, Jenny. Thank you so much for being on the show today. Before we get started today, I'd like to announce two things. First, this is a comparison episode between Mother Night and Slaughterhouse-Five, which are two amazing books by Kurt Vonnegut. You do not have to have read any of these before listening to this podcast. We will update you on plot summaries and etc. Secondly, we are using a new question/discussion format for this episode just to make sure that it's more guided than the white noise discussion was. I feel like we'll get a lot more depth out of the discussion today just since it has more guidelines. So without further ado, let's get started. So initial thoughts on both books. I want to know what you think about Slaughterhouse-Five because you texted me earlier and you were like, I don't like Slaughterhouse-Five.
Okay, so I didn't like Slaughterhouse-Five because it just seemed like, I liked Mother Night because he seemed lost in his own morals and his own moral conflict to do the right thing but to also be a spy. And I think in Slaughterhouse-Five, I just didn't get that feeling of like the moral conflict, or it was just talking about Billy Pilgrim who was...
He's kind of unsettled.
Yeah.
Yeah, like, he's not...
Like, he doesn't really have a character, in my opinion.
Things seem much more decided in Slaughterhouse-Five. In my opinion, I think that Kurt Vonnegut has ruminated over these concepts for a lifetime, and writing about war for a lifetime, and so in Slaughterhouse, he cultivates and, like, accumulates all of these decisions that he has essentially made, and it's very final, whereas in Mother Night things are loose and it leaves more up to the eye of the beholder.
Yeah.
In a way. Okay, but you liked Mother Night.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I like Mother Night better than Slaughterhouse-Five.
I think Mother Night is my favorite Kurt Vonnegut book. I've read all of them except for Jailbird, and I'm not reading Jailbird yet because I don't want it to end. I don't want to just have to reread Kurt Vonnegut books. Okay, I have a general announcement. So there is a podcast on iTunes. It's not on Acast, and it might not be on Spotify. I'm not sure. It's called Kurt Vonnegut, and Kurt Vonnegut did this brilliant series where they reviewed a Kurt Vonnegut book every week or every month or whatever, and they did all of his collective works in order. So this definitely takes some influence from Kurt Vonnegut, but I didn't want it to be a carbon copy or anything, and I just wanted to acknowledge that some of our ideas are probably going to be similar just because they're so amazing, and did such a good, thorough job on their podcast on both of these respective novels. The title, Kurt Vonnegut's Mother Night, it was taken from Goethe's Faust, and Faust, do you know the general story of Faust?
No, I just know the overview he gave in the book.
Yeah, in the introduction, he gives this overview of where both the titles for Slaughterhouse-Five and Mother Night come from. And so Faust is, basically, it's a play. Devil goes to the sky, Faust, and he says, I think it's like eternal life or something in exchange for his soul. And so Faust falls for it, but then he realizes it was the wrong decision. And so it's like the quintessential story of power and failure. And in many ways, the central plot of this is about power and failure of governments, of people, etc. And then the title, Slaughterhouse-Five.
So in Slaughterhouse-Five, so they get captured by Germans and they are marching through Dresden. and it's like really cold and they're miserable and many people die when they go through the boxcars. Eventually they get to Dresden.
It's okay. It's not a spoiler, really. They decide to take shelter in a meat locker overnight.
And that's when the bombs happen, and they hear the bombs above, like, walking around the city, and they're stuck in this meat locker.
Yeah, that's an amazing visual that Vonnegut gives in both books. And the giants were walking above us. And there are these very immaculate descriptions of people and how they react in various ways to the bombs. I think in Mother Night, there's this one woman who is, like, talking to God. She's like, what have I done? Like, what can I do to repair this? I'm so sorry for my sins. And her husband, who is a school teacher, has to actually physically knock her out and go to the Nazi, the highest Nazi in the bunker, and say, like, she was a woman, she didn't know what she was doing, and, you know, crazy blasphemous stuff like that, just in order to stay below the radar, which is so weird and so interesting.
But what I think is, like, interesting about that scene is all the children are numb to the bombs. They've heard them so many times that they barely bat an eye, whereas this woman is freaking out.
Yeah, and that's kind of a parallelism to how Howard lives his life after the war. Our first question today is, in terms of the introduction and the editor's note, why did Vonnegut add the editor's note, and what purpose does it serve to the novel as a whole? How does it work with or against our first impressions of the novel? And this is from both a new and a retrospective viewpoint.
Okay, so the editor's note in Mother Night, it's basically the synopsis of what Slaughterhouse-Five is about. So I think it kind of didn't really apply to Mother Night. So it was a bit interesting because, like, this whole synopsis he gave of it, I didn't know where it was coming from in retrospect of the actual book. But once I read Slaughterhouse-Five, I was like, oh yeah, that's how it is.
Yeah, like, the editor's note, so for people who haven't read the book, the editor's note is Kurt Vonnegut saying, in, quote, in preparing this, the American edition of The Confessions of Howard W. Campbell Jr., I have had to deal with the writing concerned, etc., etc. And he's treating Howard W. Campbell Jr., a fictional character, as a real person and saying, I went back and I patched together this diary of this person who hung himself in a prison. Whereas in the introduction, which he added 5 and 6 years after the original publication of the book, he talks about the synopsis of Slaughterhouse-Five, essentially. So you don't think that the addition of the introduction added anything?
Not really. I did like the morals he gave in the introduction.
When you're dead, you're dead?
Yeah, that's basically what. But I mean, I think, like, it makes sense that he would add it in there just because I've already read Slaughterhouse-Five, and so he is warming up to it, and he's just basically warming up to it, and I think he didn't want to write about it just yet because maybe he couldn't come to terms with it.
The introduction has one of the most famous Kurt Vonnegut quotes, and most people, I'd say, don't know where this quote is from, but here it is. We are what we pretend to be, so we must be careful about what we pretend to be. That is the first moral that he states in the introduction. That adds so much depth, and it's almost like a framing question for the book, or a framing, I don't know, some sort of guideline for the book while you're reading it, and especially if you've read this multiple times. I've read this book 4 times. So every time I read it, I think almost on every page about this quote. And it's just so pertinent to the idea of morality, which we'll get into later. Mm. All right, so second question. Consider the chronology of this novel when compared to Slaughterhouse-Five. Do you think that Vonnegut used this novel to warm up to the idea of writing Slaughterhouse-Five? I wanted to note that the first publication of Mother Night was in 1961, but it went out as a very small print, and it didn't sell because the print was so small and there was no advertising for it. So it relaunched in 1962, which is a year before Cat's Cradle was published, which is her debut breakout novel, and then a bit after Sirens of Titan, which is the second novel he wrote, but the first novel he published for all intents and purposes, came out in 1959.
I think it's better that Slaughterhouse-Five came out after Mother Night, because it's more about his story in Slaughterhouse-Five, whereas in Mother Night, he's living through the viewpoints of Howard W. Campbell Jr. and how he lives. And I think a lot of what Kurt Vonnegut thinks is through Howard W. Campbell Jr.
Yeah, like Howard W. Campbell Jr. is a mask for him almost. Yeah, and Billy Pilgrim, to an extent, is a mask as well.
Mm-hmm.
But Billy Pilgrim develops, I think, more so as a separate character, whereas Howard W. Campbell Jr. is deliberately a very vague character. And then also, we were talking about this earlier before we started shooting, but Kurt Vonnegut has an actual appearance in Slaughterhouse-Five, whereas he makes no mention of himself other than in the introduction in Mother Night.
Yeah, so I think in Slaughterhouse-Five, his character is actually, like, an onlooker.
Yeah.
Like, he's there, but he'll, like, add little blurbs.
So another thing that's important to note is the differences in chronology in each novel. So Slaughterhouse-Five jumps around a lot, whereas Mother Night is a pretty straightforward plot line. Mother Night is a frame narration. So like Wuthering Heights or The Turn of the Screw, there's this initial scene where the narrator addresses that they're writing from the future, and then they go into the past, and the whole story pretty much is the past. And then at points during the novel, think Conrad's Heart of Darkness, and then again at the end, so it's like kind of bookends, they go back to the future and comment on their experiences retrospectively. Whereas in Slaughterhouse-Five, it's like future, past, way past, future, blah. So what do you think about that?
So I think Slaughterhouse-Five is definitely more of like a sci-fi take on it, because he gets abducted by aliens who are the Tralfalmadors, and
another recurring theme in all of his books.
Yeah.
Yeah, Tralfalmador happens in almost every novel, I think.
And so they're, like, supposed to be these, like, all-knowing beings that can see everything that happens in a timeline all at once. Like, they don't see it in order like humans do, but they see it, like, they look at the Rocky Point Mountains. It's just all right there. And so in Slaughterhouse-Five, they definitely make use of that, where he goes back in time as, like, a kid, and then he'll be in the middle in the war, and then he'll go back in time to, like, a baby.
I like that connection, how Billy Pilgrim narrates the way that Tralfalmadorians would narrate.
Yeah.
That's really cool. Question 3. What kind of artist does Vonnegut seem to be in regards to the Galenson hypothesis? A conceptual or experimental artist? Does this status change with war novels in particular? Is there another artist that contrasts the way he wrote about war? So, to preface this, the Galenson hypothesis says that there are two different types of artists in the world. First, a conceptual artist. So think Picasso. He is 20 years old. He creates his first painting, and it's an instant sensation, and it instantly adds a lot to the modern art movement. Whereas experimental artist is like Cézanne, where Cézanne ruminates over and over and over. Like, he does like 50 paintings of the same scene, perhaps from different perspectives, perhaps adding colors, and some of them farther on aren't as finished as the ones earlier on. So he keeps redoing and redoing these paintings before he reaches a conclusion and then starts another painting. Another example of this would be with film. Orson Welles is like 20 years old. He makes film Citizen Kane. It's an instant sensation with film technique, whereas Hitchcock takes a whole career, and his most famous films are when he's in his 50s, and then he becomes the master of suspense. So is there an equivalent in the war genre in particular? And do you think Vonnegut is in one of those categories?
It's worth mentioning that I became obsessed with this idea after I listened to Revisionist History and it came up in an episode. So these examples come from Malcolm Gladwell in that episode.
I think Vonnegut is more of a experimental artist, because in Mother Night, he's like, it feels like he's warming up to get more in depth into the war in Slaughterhouse-Five. Then Mother Night, he talks about the war, but he doesn't necessarily talk about the horrors of war, I guess.
Yeah, he's very vague about it.
Yeah.
And he also doesn't personalize the war at all.
No, he doesn't.
Whereas in Slaughterhouse-Five, it's very clear that this is something that he's lived through.
Yeah, because, like, they're walking through the, as prisoners, they're walking through Dresden in Slaughterhouse-Five, and so they're, like, he's describing all of what they're seeing and all of what they're feeling, and it's more personal.
This is evident in his other novels as well. Some other earlier novels include Bluebeard. Rabo Karabekian is the main character in Bluebeard. He paints a scene, which is a scene that Kurt Vonnegut supposedly saw after he was released from Dresden as a prisoner of war. And that is also kind of an artistic or very visual way to start coping with that situation. And is there another writer that contrasts how he dealt with war? We were talking earlier about Roald Dahl. I read this really compelling book called Innocence. It's a collection of Roald Dahl stories. But he talks about how his first gig as a writer was to draw up a page of facts about the war and his experience in the war, because it was before America got involved in World War II. So he was supposed to draw up a page of facts for this famous writer to then put in a story and publish for himself. But Roald Dahl's quote-unquote page of facts was so eloquent that the writer actually published it as is in Roald Dahl's name. And so Roald Dahl was like a breakthrough war writer, and that's what he wrote about from the outset. And again, whereas Kurt Vonnegut sort of had to ruminate on it for a number of years before he was able to write it.
Well, I mean, I think that also just goes to their personalities. Like, maybe Roald Dahl knew exactly what he wanted to do, and so he put that forth into the media, whereas Kurt Vonnegut wasn't quite ready to put forth all that he knew and his entire personality.
Right.
And so he had to warm up to it.
Do you think that there are any other writers that you know of that kind of fit any of these?
Okay, it's in movies, but like movies like to delve into the war genre.
Yes,
because people, it's very easy to capture the audience with the war genre because it's
Dunkirk.
Terrible. Yeah, because it's terrible, and those could be your children
mm-hmm.
in the war. With Dunkirk, it's very much, you don't really delve into the characters. You don't know why they're there. You don't really get a personal feel of them, like as where maybe Hacksaw Ridge would be. Because you know why that character is there or why he's acting like he is, because
mm-hmm.
he's his own character. But in Dunkirk, I think it's more for the audience to experience it, like
right.
as if they were there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, and that speaks also to, I think Dunkirk is more of a show of technique,
mm-hmm.
And then Hacksaw Ridge is like a show of story and personableness. And it's the same with Kurt Vonnegut and Roald Dahl. Like, Kurt Vonnegut is developing his artistic style as he's revisiting these war motives over and over in his books. So Slaughterhouse-Five is a highly, highly stylized book. Like, it might not seem like it because he says, so it goes every time someone dies, stuff like that. And it's kind of weird, and the prose is a bit jerky. But, you know, Roald Dahl wasn't concerned with prose or rhythm or anything when he first published his newspaper article about the war. He was concerned with the story and how personable it would be
yeah.
to Americans. Okay, question 4. At the heart of this book is the issue of morality. What does Vonnegut seem to say about Howard's predicament?
Back to the quote of what you said.
So we are what we pretend to be?
Yeah. I think Howard W. Campbell, he's kind of forced into the role of playing the spy, because he moves to Germany with his wife, Helga, and he writes plays for the German people, and he writes them in German and everything.
Right.
And, like, he even says that maybe if he had, like, Kurt Vonnegut says, if he had lived in Germany, maybe he would have become a Nazi. And so I think it's just Howard W. Campbell pretended to be that Nazi, and so he kind of got into the role of the Nazi, and when he was forced to be a spy, he had to do do radio shows of
Howard W. Campbell doing podcasts.
Yeah. But he had to say all the Nazi things that they would usually say and bash all of
in order to communicate. So for people who haven't read the novel, it's essentially a retrospective account of an American spy working as a radio artist during the war and communicating through, like, coughs and pauses and stuff. The sniffles, the secrets that Americans on the German side want to communicate to Americans back home. So he helped out in the war tremendously, but he also helped the Germans' morale tremendously. Mm-hmm. There is this two instances I want to bring up. The first is when he meets Resi's father outside of the mansion and the family's evacuating. And his father said, "I would have liked nothing more than to have seen you get caught as an American spy for treason." And he's like, "But then I realized that no matter what, at the end of the day, you helped the Germans more than you could have ever helped the Americans." What do you think that says about morality?
He didn't really believe what he was saying necessarily on the radio shows about, like, helping the morality and everything. But I think inadvertently, he probably did help the German side more. Because multiple times, like when his Blue Fairy godmother comes, he says, like, "You were a Nazi."
Yeah, that was the other instance I wanted to talk about. Yeah, no, that's perfectly fine. Because it's so fitting for this question.
Yeah.
Where he's like, "You became a Nazi," yeah. You know? So not only was there a very small apparatus of information that he was communicating, but it was also that people suffered on his behalf. Like the 9 women that would give him messages all died in the war. Yeah. And all were supposedly tortured or dealt with. And none of them gave him up because they believed what he was doing was important. So it's just that question. And I don't think there's a direct answer to this question. I think every person has to kind of reconcile it with themselves, including Howard Neville Campbell Jr. But yeah, is there an evenness in this, in his deeds or not?
I just think it's kind of tragic how he didn't necessarily believe what he was saying, but then his wife, Helga, she started to believe that, and she truly became a Nazi.
Yeah, so you think it's kind of tipped towards the worse.
Yeah.
Because he mentions in the book, like, it would be totally fine to tell Helga that I'm not actually a Nazi, but he chooses not to tell her.
Yeah.
And then she...
That's probably for her own protection.
So we're getting into question 5, which is, how are the events and themes in this novel relevant for modern readers? The 3 main themes that we identify were identity, cruelty, and morality. So that's kind of an issue of cruelty, isn't it? Like, the person you love most in the world, and he ruminates on this concept of the nation of two the whole time, him and his wife, and when his wife died, he became a quote-unquote nationless person. It's kind of almost like a self-imposed cruelty. And in the novel, throughout the novel, he self-imposes cruelty, where he only survives off of army surplus and, like, $5 a day, and he goes through these very extreme self-imposed circumstances that are totally out of whack, but still, to him, necessary.
Well, I mean, I think it's just he wasn't necessarily living anymore, because he lost what he lived for. He lost his wife, and, I mean, he lost her both physically... And I suppose morally, because she started to believe what he was saying on those radio shows.
So Resi now. Jeez Louise. We were talking about this before the show, too, whether or not Resi was being cruel to Howard. So what happens is there's this amazing scene, and if you are reading the book, please just look at the scene in detail. Howard is over at George Kraft's house, his best friend. For all intents and purposes, his house, and he looks out the window, and all he sees are hands moving up this banister to the stairs to his attic. And it's this crazily, like, literary scene, especially for, I mean, Kurt Vonnegut is literary in a different way, but the way that he describes it and the perspective that he uses in that scene in particular is really amazing. And this is something that I didn't notice before listening to the Kurt Vonnegut podcast, so thank you guys for that. He talks about the woman's, quote, pale, ringless hand, I think is the exact quote, and then the bedazzled hand of Father Keeley. So the people with Resi.
It's amazing seeing him right there.
With the hands. The other people there. There's a Black Führer of Harlem, which is just hilarious. Okay. Father Keeley, who is a Catholic minister. And then the dentist who's with them.
Dr. Lionel J.D. Jones, D.D.S.T.D.
And there's, I think my favorite chapter in the whole book is the chapter that goes and describes him. And it talks about how he was a dentist and he went to dental school, but he kept publishing these insane like articles and essays. Like he would go through a very thorough, amazing like analytical analysis of what he was supposed to be writing about, and then every time end at due to the dental work and jawlines of African Americans and Catholics, they are inferior genetically. Mm-hmm. Like this crazy stuff, you know? And he was a Nazi at heart. Got kicked out of medical school, and then
his parents disowned him.
Yeah, his parents disowned him. Then he got his, he decided to work at a funeral home, and he married the person who owned the funeral home.
The widow.
The weird thing is he stops writing about Nazi dentistry when he is married, and he gets married again to someone who publishes doctoral degrees at a university, and he converts the system so that you, if you pay $80 or something, you can get a doctoral degree online. And so that's where he gets the DD. And then the DDS, he just added in there.
Yeah.
He felt like he was a dentist. These insane characters. And then August Crabtower is another one. And he basically leads neo-Nazi youth in America after the war. And his name is literally Crabtower. So we can see, and it's a genius on Vonnegut's part because it's spelled with a K and it's German phonetic. So it looks like a German last name, but it's this cleverly hidden message behind the name. The group's name is the Iron Guard of the White Sons of the American Constitution. And they are there because they found Howard W. Campbell Jr. along with Bernard Beauharnais. They bring what looks like Helga back
from the dead, basically.
Yes. So they, the Nation of Two is rejoined for about 24 hours until Helga breaks the news to him that she's Rezi and that she's loved him since she was 10 years old.
And he killed her dog.
Yeah, and she basically lied her way to get to him at this point.
Mm-hmm.
So that also brings up the notion of cruelty. And again, this cruelty in terms of the Blue Fairy Godmother, Frank Rattanin, he says, oh, we made Rezi and Kraft's access into the U.S. super easy, just to see what would happen.
Mm-hmm.
And he knew the whole time that both of them, from the time we meet Kraft, he goes, this guy was a Russian spy. But I'll recount the story anyway. We know from the book that both of them, and basically every character in this novel, are spies.
Yeah.
Double-sided, just like Howard W. Campbell Jr. Do you think that that spy-ness makes them, kind of alleviates the gravity of Campbell's situation? Like, normalizes it a little?
Normalizes his morality issues?
Yeah, this dual-sidedness.
Well, I think it's just unfortunate for Howard because he trusts George Kraft, and he trusts Rezi that she is Helga, and then everything, everyone basically betrays him. And so he finds out that George Kraft is a spy for the Russian side and that Rezi is also on the Russian side, and their whole goal is to get him back to Moscow.
Yeah, and it's almost like Vonnegut is saying that everyone has this kind of duality.
Yeah.
Okay, we get into the concept of identity now. So Howard W. Campbell Jr., Kraft, Heinz, who is his best friend from Germany, was actually an Israeli agent during the war, and we know at the end of the novel that Heinz is going to testify against him because he didn't know that Howard was a spy at all, and he actually hates his guts because...
Oh yeah, he was the one where he took the motorcycle from.
Mm-hmm. And he thinks, like, Heinz is truly my friend, Kraft is truly my friend, even though both of them were out to get me in the end.
Yeah,
you know, what is him. Yeah, what is true friendship, and how much of each of those relationships was true or not? And we talked about postmodern shock value in White Noise last week. And this is another instance, I think, that is just put in there for the postmodern shock value, where he is this outlandish, ridiculous situation, and it's about the depths of materialism and the depths of compassion and friendship in the face of materialism. So it's just kind of interesting. Mm-hmm. Interesting aside that Vonnegut puts in there.
But, Howard feels terrible because he never was able to return that motorcycle to him.
And Heinz is, like, pissed. In regards to all of these identity issues, what does this say about Vonnegut's thoughts on the notion of identity? And in terms of the quote from the beginning, we are what we pretend to be, are these people legitimately on both sides?
It kind of applies to Resi too, because she pretended to be Helga, and then she became Helga, and then she was able to go back to being Resi. She pretended to be that Russian spy just to get to him, but I think she always loved him. Mm-hmm. In a way.
So she was true to herself.
She was true to herself.
Despite the situation. Is the same true for Howard W. Campbell Jr.?
I don't think so. Because I don't know if he really has a self to be true to.
That's true. Yeah, and another point, too, is there's this writer in Russia who finds the collected works of Howard W. Campbell Jr. Mm-hmm. as a playwright. His name is, like, Borkachev or something.
Yeah.
And he, for all intents and purposes, he publishes everything Howard W. Campbell Jr. has ever written under his own name.
So, Bodiskov had begun to replenish the trunk with magic of his own, said Wurtinen. The police found a 2,000-page satire on the Red Army, written in a style distinctly un-Bodiskovian. For that un-Bodiskovian behavior, Bodiskov was shot. So he was killed for originality.
Which is interesting, because he wasn't killed for plagiarism, which is what you would think. Like, yeah, so Bodiskov, he, for all intents and purposes, became a writer.
Mm-hmm.
He was pretending to be a writer, and he became a writer,
mm-hmm.
Which is interesting. So Howard W. Campbell Jr. pretended to be Nazi. He was a Nazi, and he wasn't pretending to be a spy. He was a spy. So it's just kind of weird how total that transformation can be. So does Howard's suicide, which is presumably the result of guilt or feeling trapped, placate any of the negative feelings that we have towards him ultimately? Or are there negative feelings towards him ultimately?
I don't particularly have any negative feelings towards him. I think he was just a tragic character. And I think when he commits suicide, it was basically he's put on trial, but the only way that he can be innocent is if the Blue Fairy Godmother proves that he asked him to be a spy. And so once he sends a letter that proves that he's innocent, mm-hmm. Howard W. Campbell Jr.
hangs himself. This quote, that whole page, if you don't have the book, don't worry, because next week I am going to quote directly from that page. So, something to look forward to. So, related resources now. We are pretty much done with the questions. There is a movie about this book. It was directed by Keith Gordon in 1996 in Palm Sunday, which is Kurt Vonnegut's autobiographical work for all intents and purposes. It's pseudo-autobiographical. He says that he hates the movie, and the only movie that is worse than it is the movie about Happy Birthday, Wanda June. He does give this book a really great rating, though. I think it's an A or an A+. So he thinks that Mother Night is one of the best books that he wrote. My related reading, Palm Sunday by Kurt Vonnegut, Timequake by Kurt Vonnegut. It's similar in style and similar in chronology to Slaughterhouse-Five. Slapstick by Kurt Vonnegut. He wrote it for his sister. Slapstick is basically Timequake, but with a different plot. Also, I mentioned Bluebeard earlier. That has a lot of the same war motives as Mother Night. There's this article by the New York Times. It's by Doris Lessing, who's a phenomenal writer, called The Guest Word, Vonnegut's Responsibility. It's an amazing summary of his role in writing these war books.
So my related readings would be Macbeth by William Shakespeare and the moral dilemma that Macbeth goes through, because his moral dilemma is he wants to be king, mm-hmm. but he'll never become king. His wife tells him that if he were to just kill the king, then he would become the king. Mm-hmm. And so he thinks, like, originally he's like, no, I would never kill the king. But then he starts to dwell on it, and it starts to him. Yeah, and it starts to, like, sound like a really good idea. And so eventually he does kill, or the king basically goes insane because he gets consumed by guilt. And mm-hmm. and I think that really speaks to Howard, because he had the moral dilemma of becoming a Nazi and then mm-hmm. his wife becoming a Nazi.
Awesome. Okay, so next segment is favorite quotes. I have a ton. I love these little one-liners that Vonnegut does, and They just crack me up. Sirens of Titan, I think, is the best book for one-liners out there. I think one of them is the planet Mercury sings like a crystal goblet. It sings all the time. Just that kind of like whimsical one-liner writing. I love it. So in Mother Night, I'm about to be free again to wander where I please. I find the prospect nauseating. This is my senior quote. I will elaborate more on that next week. My neighbor is a foxy old man named George Kraft. What could be worse than hell? Purgatory. And then the next chapter is called Purgatory. I am neither ignorant nor insane. And this is the Black Fear of Harlem. Howard W. Campbell is knocked out by a janitor, and he's like,